The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. We're going to continue from what we talked about last week, and it really is one of the great themes, if not the great theme, of this radio program and this radio project, and that is the understanding of the Russian and Ukrainian concept of nationalism as a form of anti-bureaucratic, anti-statist ethno-federalism. And last week we dealt with the short-lived but extremely influential proponent of that idea in the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius. And tonight and next week, we're going to talk about two members of that brotherhood, two very famous members of that brotherhood, Mikhailo Drahomanov and Taras Shevchenko, the latter being far more famous than the former. That might be unjust, but Shevchenko became, as some of you know, the national poet of Ukraine, and as a result has developed a certain international following as a result of that. Drahomanov is far less significant globally, although that's a shame, but as far as Ukraine is concerned, he is a major, albeit eccentric, political writer, and although I have to say primarily he was a folklorist, but when you understand the slow beginning of the ethno-federalist idea, folklore becomes a central ingredient, because folklore is the voice of the people, especially in rural areas, the voice of the common people spread out over time in these stories and songs that contain all kinds of moral and religious and political truths. And so people like Matyumovich and Drahomanov, they were concerned in their early career almost exclusively with collecting as many of these folk songs as possible, because the understanding is that true populism comes from the people. And when we talk about the people, we're not talking about some abstraction. We're talking about how the people have expressed themselves in a specific language and political culture through their folk songs and traditions and folk poetry. This stuff is not to be ignored. This stuff is to be understood as the central ethical expression of the people as a whole, and in fact, what makes a people a people. So we're not dealing with that fake modern Jacobin idea of the people as some abstraction. And this is the reason that Drahomanov will reject in vehement terms the French Revolution. So you're talking about the development of an ethno-federalism that is fairly revolutionary in its understanding of political authority and legitimacy, but ultimately is dedicated to and based upon the ancient tradition of the people of which they're talking about. In this case, Drahomanov is talking not merely about the Ukrainians, but also the Russians. Russians meaning those based in St. Petersburg, Moscow. And so Drahomanov views them in the same way that Gogol viewed them, in the same way that I do, in fact, as two great peoples with tremendous cultural richness that, given purely contingent historical circumstances, have largely opposed each other. And the concept is that both are equal, great peoples, who should both be independent and yet connected to one another by very close ties of religious brotherhood. Drahomanov is an eccentric expression of the Ukrainian idea, and I'll say that he is closer to Gogol in his basic political approach than he is to Shevchenko. And for all of these men, I think almost without exception, they are opposed to the idea of any centralized structure of any kind. And that would include the state, the economy, and the church. The individual, the family, the village, these are the things that upon which society rests. And as a result of that, these are the basic building blocks of real democracy, not in its phony modern sense, and social progress. And in fact, Drahomanov is going to spend a lot of time redefining the very concept of progress. And a 1952 article by Ivan Rudnitsky has been extremely important in spreading this to an English-speaking society. The state, in order to be even remotely legitimate, needs to be limited. And in good communitarian tradition, Drahomanov holds that the intermediate institutions of society are central, both in terms of legitimate rule, the interpretation of law, and the control of any centralized structures. Intermediate institutions would include things like the urban brotherhoods and guilds, parishes and monasteries, civic societies of any kind, all of which, in order to be legitimate institutions, have to be based on the idea of subunaprawna and mutual aid. That's the whole purpose of these institutions. And I want to say that Drahomanov is a follower of some, in some regard, of the French anarchist Pierre Proudhon. And he is somebody worth reading. He is somebody that I will do a show on one of these days. And all of this goes back to the corruption and incompetence of the contemporary academic establishment. Because over the last 100 years, this establishment has created what we can call, for lack of a better term, a canon of worthwhile political theorists. And, you know, it generally starts with Plato and ends up sort of with modern diversity nonsense. And what it's based on is a philosophy of history. And they choose which political writers are worth discussing on the basis of the extent to which they ultimately justify the coming of the totalitarian state, Marxism, and eventually the New World Order. New World Order being this very tight centralized alliance among economic actors, non-governmental organizations, and a certain handful of powerful states. Not to mention media. Of course, media is really a part of capital. And people like Drahomanov and Proudhon have been almost completely dropped out of the radical pantheon, largely because they weren't Marxists. And for these people, you know, you go from Hegel to Marx, Marx being the ultimate expression of any kind of radical idea, and a lot of the anarchists, especially your more ethnic and nationally based anarchists, are thrown out the window as being inconvenient. So it's arbitrary who gets included in the system and who gets excluded. You know, it's arbitrary in the sense that it's not based on any merit. It's based on this philosophy of history that's built into the very canon of the history of political thought. And philosophy is no different. So there's a political agenda that's built in to the writing of the history of political theory, and it's based around this unfolding of this neo-Marxist totalitarian state. I mean, you got to remember that the Marxism and modern, anyway, or postmodern capitalism are almost identical. They are totalitarian systems. They are material systems. They hold different cultures and traditions in absolute contempt. They want to remake the world. They want to remake nature. They want to remake people and cultures and traditions in their own image. Marx wanted a single global system ruled from one center that controlled all aspects of society, which in his mind was the creation of a single global factory where agriculture as well as industry became factories, that they weren't distinct in how they functioned in terms of production. And that was attempted to be put into practice by Lenin and his successors at the cost of tens of millions of lives, which, you know, according to the system, was a legitimate sacrifice. And I mean that literally and religiously, a legitimate sacrifice for what they call progress. Of course, in the modern world, global capitalism also has created agricultural factories populated by serfs. And in America, if you are a small farmer, largely you are dependent on and completely controlled by the major agribusiness organizations who are deep into government and media, ConAgra, Archer Daniels Midland, Tyson, and the rest of it. Often the land is owned by the company, seed and technology is owned by the company, and therefore, in every useful sense of the word, the small farmer is a serf who cannot leave the structure of the company. And so that is serfdom by anyone's definition. And of course, those people are largely invisible as far as the media are concerned. Drahomanov, however, while accepting this and really promoting this ethno-federalist system, somewhat along the lines of Proudhon. And Proudhon is one of these people dropped out of the history of political thought due to his inconvenience, the fact that he's not obviously on the left or the right of the political spectrum. And the march of the left, in speaking broadly, is the philosophy of history built into this stuff and the justification of leftist control over everything is the whole purpose of writing political theory, at least in modern times. Drahomanov was no Republican, because he recognized two things. He recognized, number one, Republican systems are based on money, and they come into existence and function because the oligarchy wants to share power, and either will elect someone to rule over them, although, you know, the rule is largely a sham, and it's, you know, that person is their creation, and therefore has no real power, or creates a republic where they could rule more or less in succession. So for him, republicanism is an oligarchy, number one, and number two is tightly centralized and really is based on the worship of money. And again, in a religious sense, they will sacrifice large numbers of people and their livelihood for the sake of maintaining their position. And I want to, along with people like Mike Hoffman, I want to make it clear that when I say the word sacrifice, I mean it. For every development in technology, there is a required sacrifice. So when you develop something like electricity, the sacrifice are thousands of people who are electrocuted. When you develop the automobile, the sacrifice is millions of people killed in auto accidents. When you develop the factory, the sacrifice is God knows how many mutilated and killed child laborers and adult laborers over the decades, and of course the destruction of the natural environment and the life of the miners, the coal miners, which is hell on earth. And for those who accept this kind of technical definition of progress, these tens of millions of lives over the years are an acceptable sacrifice for the benefits and convenience that they enjoy. So for any of these technical inventions, there usually is the sacrifice of thousands, if not millions, of people as a direct result of its introduction and popularization. And it's very difficult to come up with any exceptions to that rule. And for Drahmanov, progress is economic, but an economics that is based strictly within the moral sphere. For him, the ultimate form of government, the only form of government really that works as something that's legitimately democratic, populist, is federalism. Country based on regional differences, united relatively loosely in one center. And we talked last time about the notion of the Slavic Federation, and to a great extent, this is what Drahmanov and the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius largely have in common. A federation of different peoples loosely connected in one center, with the government as close to the locale as possible, as close to the local level as possible. And for both the British Revolution, 17th century, and the French Revolution, following century, they were intensely bloody affairs because it essentially was an oligarchy in both cases, which took over based on their connections with the money centers of the world. And they used the abstraction of the people, in quotes, to justify their control. But the people are not this abstract entity existing only in the minds of the academic or the revolutionary. And that's why folklore means so much, and that's why ethno-federalism means so much. Drahmanov considers the economy first from the point of view of the Garden of Eden. Men actually worked in the Garden of Eden. They worked in this golden age, but the work was easy and rewarding, and nature did not resist the labor of the working man. Of course, Drahmanov holds that Eden actually, you know, was a golden age of mankind, certainly more than just Adam and Eve in this garden, although they were symbolic of those people who fell, and who fell into the dualism of the human will on one side and matter on the other. And this dualistic conception, which will be nullified in Christ's incarnation, is about the elite will demanding the entire world be conformed to its will, its purposes, and its convenience, which can be fetishized as technology and the human sacrifice required for technology to function, symbolized largely by the Tower of Babel and the worship of Moloch in the Levant. But it is the cancellation of that dualism and the creation of a moral economy that's at the basis of progress. And so he has radically altered the typical conception of progress. And it is ideas that drive this particular movement. But these ideas have to be based in a specific national way of life, an ethnos based on the expression of the common population. Again, folklore means everything to him, because only this really showed not their preference of the moment, but their historical expression over time, over generations. That's why it's so important. It's the people as a concept, but not as an abstract concept. So for him, it was progress would lead to the following. True progress will lead to a national federalism, a true populist democracy, and as Urednitsky and others call it, a plebeian nationalism, a nationalism based on the working man and the farmer. He is, like Proudhon, a decentralized socialist. And I use the word kind of in a guarded sort of a way. But that any kind of socialism, any kind of labor reform, and the labor centeredness of the economy has to be national. And that the true liberation of the working man and the peasant can only be based on the historical self-understanding of the people as a whole. And when I debate with these fake anarchists out there, these leftist anarchists, who frankly I don't think believe a word of what they say, I always ask them, when you create these communes, what is the basis of solidarity? And I usually get a blank stare because they usually don't know what I'm talking about. There's got to be something that holds them together in these kind of basic intermediate communal existences, which is, you know, it's both a modern and a medieval concept. What holds them together? I mean, they got to have a basic moral agreement, religious and spiritual agreement. They've got to certainly, I mean, at a minimum, speak the same language and have the same basic expectations for the future. That sounds exactly like the national idea to me. And of course, they usually have no idea what I'm talking about because I've never heard it before. Generally, what the leftist anarchists are really all about is simply imposing their ultra-liberal view on anybody else through violence. So they're about as anarchist as the chair I'm sitting on. It's mostly a phony big money movement like all the left in America and elsewhere. But Drahmanov, on the other hand, was precisely the opposite. He recognized that any kind of federalism has to be based not just on the idea of the ethnic tradition, but this ethnic tradition has to be the basis of solidarity, which in turn implies the emancipation of labor and the farmer. Serfdom, landlordism, the bosses, none of these are, at least in their normal understandings, none of these are compatible with a truly ethnic solidarity, or really any kind of national or local solidarity whatsoever. And so his single universal political truth is what we've called for the last several years on this program social nationalism. The idea that if nationalism is based on ethnic and cultural solidarity, and that's the only useful concept of the word nationalism, if it is truly based on that, then it also strongly implies that the farmer and the worker need to be emancipated from the materialist system that they slave under and need to be their own bosses and elect their own managers and have a inherent right to property, as we talked about in the talk on the Brotherhood. And he usually laughs at this concept of Marxism, that Marxism largely is the mind of the Jewish urban intellectual. The last people who are writing on socialism are actual workers. Actual workers have nothing to do with socialism. Socialism is a result of this urban academic class having no connection whatsoever to the working masses of the society. The only difference between the regime then and now is that no one talks about the working class anymore. It's still Marxism, but since Marxism never has been about the working class to begin with, it's been about the elite and the transformation of nature and the state, neither is this modern neo-Marxism. And what they use today, and you see this in the American media and academia, they won't talk about workers. They will talk about racial minorities, they'll talk about Jews, they'll talk about women, they'll talk about whatever group is fashionable at the moment. They have taken the place of the working class in this neo-Marxist idea. It's absolutely identical because they demand a centralized police state that oversees the behavior of all of its members, and that's the case right now in the university, where you have no privacy and everything you do and say is monitored by the university system, including your email address. And if you use the university computer network, you are not allowed to go on sites like the one that you're on right now. It is a police state, and I've always said that the American university is the kernel of the New World Order and the society that they want to create. Okay, we're going to continue with ethno-federalism and Drahmanov when we return. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back, everyone, to the Orthodox Nationalist. We're talking about Ukrainian political thought and ethnic nationalism within the mentality of Mihailo, or Michael Drahmanov, a member of the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius, who we spoke about last week. And then next week, we're going to deal with Taras Shevchenko. And the week after that, an earlier figure, but a similar figure, Francis Skodnia of Belarus, who's more of a Renaissance figure, but I think from the point of view of politics is very similar to what we're dealing with now. And we're talking about socialism. And socialism has been the watchword of the West for many years. It's central in the concept of the New World Order. But of course, Marxism never has had anything to do with labor. It has to do with the creation of a centralized global factory system. Culturalist, identityless, overseen by a tiny clique of bureaucrat intellectuals. To a great extent, that is what the American university is. And the Marxist view is about the recreation of the globe. Certainly has nothing to do with workers, and workers were no better off in the Soviet Union than they were anywhere else. And for people like Drahmanov, he predicted this. Proudhon, even Bakunin, they all predicted this. That they all viewed socialism as essentially Jewish, and they all viewed it as coming from the Rothschild clan, and they viewed it as not about emancipating labor, but in fact enslaving all people to the global centralized state. But it doesn't mean that these men were non-socialists. They were socialists in the best sense of the word. They believed in solidarity and community, but these things based on very specific languages and customs and general expectations. Without those, you could have no community at all. And he believed in a sort of a reformist socialism where this gradual emancipation of labor will come at the local level. Slowly but surely, these intermediate institutions will take more and more power, become more and more autarkic, and the state, that is to say the bureaucratic apparatus that oversees everything, will be disempowered. And that's his view, and that's quite a workable idea of this legitimate kind of anarchist and ethnic socialism. And you see it to a great extent in the anti-federalists in America. You see it in the 19th century Irish nationalist thinking. It's not an uncommon concept. And the Russian commune in the mind of the Slavophiles, you see it there as well. For people like Drahmanov, you know, Drahmanov didn't think that Russia was this inherently evil place. Gogol certainly did not think that. It was the empire that was the problem. you know, I have a strong Irish nationalist and Celtic streak in me, being an Irishman myself. But it's not England that's the problem. It's not the British mind. It's not the British tradition. None of these are in and of themselves a problem. In fact, they should be preserved. The empire, however, is another matter. Empires are inherently manipulative. They use the ethnic tradition of the core group for the sake of justifying their manipulation of others. It is not nationalism by definition. An empire is internationalist by its very constitution. But if you base political legitimacy on the cultural solidarity of a people, then necessarily an empire is morally illegitimate. I mean, the only way it would work is if the center of the empire was a fairly loose association of ethnic groups, more or less independent at the domestic level, but the empire takes care of certain aspects of foreign policy. And you see that to some extent with the Austrian Empire. You don't see it so much in the Empire of St. Petersburg, with the exception of Finland, and even to some extent Poland, because Poland was largely self-governed and had its own constitution. Finland operated as an independent country, even though technically it was under Russian control. So you have different aspects of that kind. But, you know, in that case, it's an empire in name. You're really talking about a confederation of independent peoples. The basis still is not some bureaucratic center. It is the living, breathing cultural tradition of a people. And even so far as Drahomanov and Gogol largely were royalists in their general point of view. However, the monarchy in and of itself was never the problem. The monarchy can be legitimate under many circumstances. The bureaucracy is the problem. When we talk about the centralized state, we're not talking about a monarch. The monarch can't be a state. He's a person. It's an office. No, the state is the coercive, self-interested, conformist bureaucracy that rules almost exclusively by force and coercion, extracting as much resources out of the population as they can possibly get away with, in one form or another. That's what they're talking about. And questions of monarchy or republics or Rousseauian general will, these things are irrelevant. Justice can be found in any number of political systems. The question is centralization. And the question of centralization is based in turn upon the power and coercive apparatus of the bureaucracy. So we have to be very clear as to what we're talking about. Bureaucracy is a problem because it is self-interested and conformist, and bureaucrats live and work for the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is its own end. It doesn't serve anyone but itself, and that's inherent in the bureaucratic and conformist mentality. So, when you're talking about social reform and the growth of these intermediate institutions, such as the brotherhoods and the guilds or anything else, you're talking about their specific historical and moral condition. The local level is always dominant, and any government that wants to be legitimate has to be based on locality, because only there can you experience how people live in their day-to-day capacity. Now, labor as such is only a part of this. There are many other sectors that are a part of this movement for general federalism and social reform. And although a socialist, he rejected any sense of economic determinism. He rejected economic determinism because ultimately it was ethnic and religious solidarity that dominated everything. including how things and why things are produced. Production and consumption do not exist in and of themselves. They exist only for the social whole. And, you know, he saw the Russian revolutionaries and these Jewish Bolsheviks, which were just getting started in the 1850s and 60s, he saw them as absolutely Machiavellian. And everything that came out of the Bolshevik Revolution was predicted to a great extent by Drahmanov, just as the centralized American state and its economic oligarchy that controls it, all of this was predicted by the anti-federalists. So you have a very similar relationship here, that the minute government rejects and separates itself and abstracts itself from the locality, from the customs and tradition of the people over which it rules, it becomes a self-interested monster serving only itself, and more specifically in the American case, serving the handful of banks and major corporate interests who control every aspect of this system. But he does view Ukraine as different. Ukraine is part of Central Europe. It's part of the European artistic and moral tradition. Russia is not. Russia is part of the Eurasian tradition. And he doesn't make any moral distinctions, just that that's a simple fact of history. Russian control over Ukraine didn't happen by some kind of violent conquest. It happened because the higher level Cossack aristocracy, developing long after Khmelnytsky and throughout early modernity, was granted serfs by the Russian government in exchange for loyalty. In other words, they bought them off. And once that happened, once the ideals of the Cossack Brotherhood were torn asunder by this kind of bribery, especially during the reign of Catherine II in the late 18th century, that they were permitted to own serfs and large chunks of land, and that would be protected by the Russian government so long as they're loyal, most of these upper-class Cossacks took the bait. And once they did that, according to Drahmanov, Ukraine was doomed, at least in the short term. Ukraine was always the slave mart of the Asiatic world. It was white Africa in the mentality of Drahmanov, perpetually enslaved, quite literally, as in the case of the Turks and other raiders on Ukrainian territory. We've dealt with that before. And enslaved in a dependent colonial relationship right up throughout the Soviet era. So the concept of white Africa was something that submerged and enslaved peoples. And you know, again, in the case of the Irish, who were quite literally enslaved after the genocide of Cromwell in Ireland and the Caribbean, something that's largely been whitewashed from history. The condition both of Ukraine and Ireland has been one of a white Africa. And yet, Drahmanov was opposed to open independence at the time, although he probably believed it, did not express it because he didn't think at the time it was practical. Had a strong Austrian Empire, a strong Turkish Empire, this is in the 1840s, 50s, a weakening and yet still powerful Turkish Empire and a Russian Empire surrounding Ukraine. Chances of her independence were minimal. She has to think practically, not dogmatically, about these things. And as far as the national intellectuals are concerned, they cannot hate anybody. True nationalism is about loving your own people and their traditions and recognizing the legitimacy of that kind of love amongst all of your neighbors. You cannot demonize these people. You can attack the government and the empire. That's not the same thing as attacking the common people in these other countries. But the national intellectual only is himself a legitimate social force to the extent that he is a part of the national collective, that he speaks the same language, has the same feelings and expectations as the common people who are reading his stuff. They've got to form a single integral whole, like everything else in social life. Now, the very famous Ukrainian historian, Dmytro Doroshenko, who is an equal to Hrushevsky, in my opinion, himself wrote an article on Drahmanov. And in this case, you're talking about a major primary source in Ukrainian history, talking about, in a secondary way, a major figure. Doroshenko is probably more famous than Drahmanov. And so, because of his historical work in establishing the Ukrainian idea in the West, Doroshenko writes this article really about the nature of Ukrainian history relative to the Brotherhood of St. Cyril and Methodius, and in particular, Mikhailo Drahmanov's political theory. And he views, first of all, Drahmanov as a pan-Russian figure. And so he's using the word Russian in the same way that I use the word Russian. We're not just talking about Moscow or St. Petersburg. We're also talking about Kiev and Minsk. We're talking about all of the Rus people, different, culturally distinct, and yet still part of the all-Rus cultural background. But it was his love of folklore that brought him to the Ukrainian national idea. He studied folklore from throughout the Slavic world, but one of the ways that he proved how distinct the different Slavic people are is by reading their folklore. It's often about very different topics depending on the cultural and economic conditions of the people. And popular history is to be found in these folk songs. And therefore, if you're going to write a truly national history about anybody, you need to learn from the bottom up. What were these people concerned with? What did they fear? What did they love? All of these are legitimate, but you have to start there. You don't necessarily start from kings and popes and bishops. Although, I mean, some people have accused Doroshenko of doing just that. It doesn't matter. The point is, in order for something to be truly national, it has to start from the true popular basis of the country. Doroshenko, like some Ukrainian nationalists, will not romanticize the Cossack knightly order. There's really two views, very general views on the Cossacks, and the one is that the Cossacks really were the Ukrainian idea and the continuation of Orthodox Kievan Rus. And I have great sympathy for that position. That was a position of Taras Shevchenko. On the other hand, Doroshenko and to some extent Khrushchevsky, especially when dealing with Khmelnytsky, don't want to romanticize the Cossacks. They all accept their heroic role in rescuing thousands of Slavic slaves and fighting the landlords and fighting both the Poles and the Russians and anybody else who got in their way. At the same time, the second view of the Cossacks says that they were generally a self-interested group. They were separate from the rest of the population, and they served the order and the order alone. And those are the two general points of view. That latter point of view is one that Doroshenko has a tendency to hold. The Cossacks were generally a progressive force, but they didn't exist in and of themselves. There were many progressive forces and elements in the Pan-Slavic universe throughout its history. The way that Drahmanov viewed Ukraine's political future was essentially an all-Russian federation with great local autonomy. In this case, based on ethnicity, that there is a legitimate, purpose for the Russian Empire, but the Empire can only be legitimate if and only if it ultimately transforms itself into a loose confederation of different peoples united under the monarchy. Preferably not in St. Petersburg, which is essentially a foreign city, but Moscow. And of course, in the Brotherhood concept, the Pan-Slavic Federation, similar, but based in Kiev. Regardless of those differences, the concept is more or less the same. And I think the one thing that all of the Brotherhood members accepted was the idea of a Slavic federation of one kind or another, which, if you extrapolate that, ultimately is about a global federation. That ethnic groups that generally have a lot in common with each other should form very loose, decentralized federations of local institutions. If there's any attempt, if there's any hope of gaining real, popular, legitimate government in the true sense of the term, that, as far as they're concerned, is probably the only way to go. And really the worst element is its opposite. The worst element is centralization of any kind of power, when centralization implies that it has been removed from the life of the people. And that there needs to be this general brotherhood and friendship amongst all Slavic peoples. And of course, you can extrapolate that from any different region of the world and those kindred peoples in a federation. So, and really what Doroshenko is talking about is that while royalism may have a place in the mentality of Drahomanov, it is very much in the Slavophile tradition. And I want to stress again that this whole thing, and the people who we've been dealing with, really are the Ukrainian expression of the same Slavophile idea. Monarchy is legitimate. That's not the same thing as the state. The state is that bureaucratic apparatus that really doesn't care if there's a monarch or not. And this has to be stressed. When you're talking about, you know, politicians, no matter where they are, they generally don't have very much power. Especially in democratic systems, in the United States, for example, politicians don't really matter. If there were no politicians elected, if all the congressmen went home, let's say, for 5 years, would anything really change? And the answer, of course, is no. The bureaucracy would continue to administer the country the way it always has. When you elect a president, and the president then appoints his cabinet ministers, nothing has changed. The bureaucracy is more or less the same. It's very hard to fire those people. The bureaucracy and the way that policy is implemented is exactly the same no matter who's in the White House, and a cabinet minister is little more than the overseer of bureaucratic functioning within their competence, while the president is little more than the overseer of the cabinet. If these people were all to disappear, nothing would change because the bureaucracy would continue to function the way that it always has, with the same people doing the same things, because the bureaucracy is independent of any political organization that is elected. And ultimately what Democratic and Republican politicians and elections really are is that big money in the banks can finance candidates, get them elected, and when anything goes wrong in the economy, the politicians are blamed, as if the politicians have any control over the economics of the society. They don't even have control over the dollar. And that's the point of elections. These politicians have very little power. They cannot control the bureaucracy or the judiciary, so they have no power really whatsoever. And their purpose is to take the blame whenever corporate America or the banks do something wrong. So if the economy goes in the tank, they blame the president, as if the president has any control over these things. No, banks and corporations, they do have control over these things. They are the economy. So this has to be stressed to a great extent. We're not talking about bureaucratic conformism. When you talk about Kostomarov and people like Doroshenko, we're talking about the notion of a monarch as an icon of the church, of the population, of what's best in the ethnic tradition. He doesn't rule, no more than a bishop should rule. They simply express a certain form of unity over the traditions of the people over which they rule. Doroshenko, though, is very, you know, he says populism is a problem because he wants to remind everybody that the mob in Ukraine wanted Russian protection. The mob was very interested in attacking anybody who seemed to be pro-Polish or pro-Turkish and instead looked to Russia. Russia, in fact, was the popular choice in Doroshenko's mind, although quite possibly not the right one. It may have been the only one under the circumstances, in which case right and wrong are irrelevant if there's simply no choice in the matter. Finally, Doroshenko says that political ideas ultimately only come from a sense of national identity. Otherwise, they're abstractions. If they're abstractions, they either have no meaning or have to be imposed by force. And that thesis was the topic of my doctoral dissertation, because Michael Oakeshott actually took that thesis and ran with it. If political theory, political ideas are not anchored in the actual living ethnic tradition, with its language and customs and general agreement about its history and future, political ideas are either meaningless or they have to be imposed by force. And it's that abstraction which lies at the root of bureaucracy, capitalism, the state, and all of these oppressive forces. So, that is a very brief thumbnail sketch of Drahmanov and his significance. And next week we're going to deal with the Ukrainian, the national poet of Ukraine, and probably the most famous Ukrainian writer of all time, Taras Shevchenko. So, until then, goodbye and God bless.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Radio Ariane.